Only two here.
Let's just make
notice how it says public hearing.
Darn.
I still have the gavel, remember, guys.
I thought we were born yesterday.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. We are still expecting, hopefully, a few other members, but in the meantime, since it is already six after three, we're going to start with an informational meeting. So I will go ahead and open up an informational meeting. Colleagues, the reason that we're starting with the informational meeting instead of diving right into the public hearings on the two bills that you see in front of you, and you probably figured out today, is Energy Day at the committee, because I wanted to ask the Department of Energy to come up and talk about our planning process for all the different type of energy programs we have, looking at renewable energy, looking at making sure we're meeting our energy demands. We have multiple requirements in statute that the Department of Energy is implementing. And then we're going to hear two bills. One of them has been brought to you by the Department of Energy, and the other one has been brought to you by the chair that will sort of segue on some of the information we're going to hear today. So I've asked Director Bob Repine and his assistant, I guess Diane is going to be with you, to provide an overview. The Department of Energy, Senator Thompson, this is going to be a little bit repeat for you because we've already heard the Department of Energy's budget and ways and means, but for other folks it won't. And then also talk a little bit about the energy plan that the Department of Energy has been working on now for many years and is required to come to the legislature, I think, and present that plan. So we're going to hear today from Director Repine and Ms. Enright. Thank you for being here. And I think you have some present. Do you have a PowerPoint? presentation? Do you have a PowerPoint?
Yes, we do.
Okay, yeah. Excellent.
So, Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I am Bob Repine, Acting Director for the Department of Energy. As the chair has announced, the purpose of this presentation is really just to give you kind of a higher level slideshow, lack of a better way of describing it, of the energy report that we just have published. And it goes in, and we'll go through certain details of it in the presentation. We're handing out the hard copies to you. It's also available on our website, so you don't have to have a paper copy if you don't want. So it's available that you can download it and put it in your computers.
And, Bob, I'm just going to remind people in the audience to make sure your phones are turned off, please. Just a reminder. Thank you. Yeah.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, I thought it was worthy of bringing this document to just show it to you. Just to let you know that the state of Oregon has been deeply involved in energy planning for many a year. This is a document under the McCall administration produced by the agency back in 1975. For those who follow eBay, this document is valued today, if you want to buy it on eBay, for $329. So,
do you want to read it for the people
who
can't tell what it is?
If you want cheap duplicates, we can copy it on our copy machine. It's a fascinating report for a variety of reasons, just if nothing else from a historical perspective. You can tell somebody spent a lot of time typing this out. Mm-hmm. And then all the charts and everything, as the cover is somebody has spent an enormous amount of time having an art program to draw a very interesting cultural cover on that. I thought, you know,
it's an energy plan from what year?
1975. So if you think about the plan that we're going to present today, it has a long history in the state of Oregon as being produced for the purpose of consideration and informational sharing with the legislature and people who in the state of Oregon who are interested in knowing what has been going on as it pertains to energy-related issues. And it has obviously changed greatly since 1975 to where it is today. So with that, I'm going to let Diana kind of start the presentation, and we'll, when it's completed, we'll take some other questions from you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Diana Enright. I'm the Communications Manager for the Oregon Department of Energy. For this current 2011-2013 Biennial Energy Plan, I was part writer, editor, and researcher. And as a researcher, I started the process of putting the plan together by going back and looking at 35 years worth of energy plans and reports. And looking back over all the documents I could find in our archives at work, what I came across was one theme that stood out, which is that energy planning in Oregon is set on a foundation of energy conservation. It's the cheapest energy resource that we can acquire. So one of the themes through all the documents was building energy policy on a conservation foundation. Other material that I gathered for the plan came from the agency's technical staff and the subject matter experts that work at the Department of Energy. They work with their stakeholders and with their peers to look down the road and see what's coming as far as energy challenges and opportunities. And they provided a lot of that information for the document that we just released. So a little bit about the Department of Energy. We were formed in 1975, and the designation was for us to do a number of things, including being a central repository of energy resource data, to prepare contingency plans, and to develop comprehensive energy plans. And in our statute, ORS 469, the legislature said that Oregon should not be left a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, and directed the department to work on comprehensive energy planning. And as Bob just showed you, and for those who couldn't see the cover, this is what the cover looks like. It was the 70s. And
wow, man.
Actually, I could show you, there's some incredible line drawings in here of the sun and as kind of an entity and what the sun does and solar energy. But the document was considered groundbreaking for its time because it asked the question about Oregon's energy future. Will it be a nuclear future or a solar future? And that was basically the premise of the document. So it's still filled with a lot of valuable information and also apparently very valuable. The agency started by doing annual energy reports looking at Oregon's energy future. The first one was issued in 1977. It looked at energy use, energy resources, forecast modeling, and the results of that modeling. One of the things it also did was it looked at the connection in 1977 between energy and job creation. What the report says was it should be emphasized that there are no simple or static relationships between energy consumption, employment, and economic growth. But clearly, energy is a prerequisite to job-producing economic activity. In 1980, energy planning changed because it became planning on a regional level. That was when Congress passed the Northwest Power Planning Act and set up what is now known as the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. And the act authorizes the council to prepare and adopt regional conservation and electric power plans. But over the years, since 1975, there have been many energy plans and planning documents and reports, and it was quite interesting to go through our archives and see what I could come up with. So some of the ones from the early 80s, the Oregon Sun Book, which was about solar energy. We produced an energy guide for Oregon grocers to help them reduce their energy consumption. Energy and conservation in water and wastewater systems, energy management in state buildings, a commercial energy study of restaurants, and an Oregon automobile survey of driving patterns and driving attitudes from 1985. And that was a rather interesting document, a thin thing, but looked at survey drivers and saw that a lot of them would be interested in any energy-saving ideas for how to save gasoline, this coming not long after the energy crisis of the 70s. After 85, there were other documents. In 1988, Oregon Energy Investments, and in 1990, the Oregon Petroleum Contingency Plan and the Oregon Task Force on Global Warming report to the governor and the legislature in 1990. But then in 85, the agency switched to a biennial energy plan, and that was following legislative direction in 1983 in Senate Bill 212. So the plan came out every 2 years. And the first plan said that Oregon energy policy establishes an ethic of energy efficiency which must be maintained even during a surplus. So since the first biennial plan, the format has basically been the same for all the biennial plans. And generally, there's a section on energy supply and demand, conservation, renewable, and conventional resources, energy issues, including environmental and health issues, and an action plan over the next 2 years where we go from here. So that's kind of what we've done in the past, and so where are we today? Well, the current plan recently produced is basically follows a very similar format. It looks at Oregon's energy history, because what you find with energy issues is that they're very cyclical over time. There's energy supply and demand, which is kind of energy 101. Where do we get our energy from? How much do we use? What's in our electricity mix? Where does our petroleum come from, and how do we use it, and how is it transported? It also looks at some of the energy issues facing Oregon and what's in Oregon's energy future, and that includes everything from transmission line development to electric vehicles. Besides our plan, there are a number of plans that are external to the agency. And just kind of a brief list of some of the other planning efforts that go on around energy issues. As I mentioned, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and their recently released sixth power plan. The Public Utility Commission does integrated resource plans with the utilities. The Global Warming Commission has their roadmap to 2020 coming out. There's a Sustainable Transportation Initiative, Senate Bill 1059 and House Bill 2001, which looks at how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector. The Western Governors Association has a number of efforts, including the Western Renewable Energy Zones. And an organization called Northwest SEED, Sustainable Energy for Economic Development, is working on energy planning with the Northwest Indian tribes. The 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon are very interested in energy issues and in energy development. So where we are now, when I looked back over 35 years worth of documents, is that we're in a more diverse energy world. Prices and issues have become increasingly complex and global and controversial. People have instant access to information, and they want to know answers immediately. And more people are paying attention to how we use and obtain our energy. So what we've been hearing from a number of stakeholders is that Oregon needs an energy plan. And we kept thinking, well, we have lots of energy plans. What is really needed? What are people really asking for? And we came to the conclusion that what people really want is an energy strategy, something, a more integrated approach that involves more people and more issues. And a strategy could move just beyond the energy world to include such things as land use, water resources, affordable housing, economic development, the purchasing of energy-efficient products, and transportation issues. So going back to our first biennial plan in 1985, it said we must pursue mutual objectives that are consistent with state energy policy through cooperative efforts with utilities, local governments, and others. So how do we get to a strategy? I think we start to focus on who the others are from our first plan. And it's the others we need to bring more fully into the planning process to help develop an Oregon energy strategy. So what do we need in a plan as we go forward, a new plan or a new strategy? Well, it can involve a number of things. There can be modeling. This is from one of our old plans. You start at the top with people and their homes, and you look at a variety of things and get to total energy use. So you can include modeling. A plan usually and can include issue discussion, everything from electromagnetic fields to fish to the intermittent nature of renewable energy. Plans also have shown accomplishments. In 1982, the sixth annual report said, despite prospects of a bleak economy, at least in the short term, Oregon homeowners show a strong willingness to invest in measures to control the rising costs of electricity, natural gas, and home heating oil. And plans can have specific objectives. What do you want to accomplish with your plan or your strategy? Do you want to obtain all available conservation, reduce reliance on fossil fuels, help develop and promote emerging technologies, keep more of the $14 billion that Oregonians spend annually on energy in the state and use it for economic growth, or reduce greenhouse gas emissions? So finally, what an energy plan is. It's good, solid information, as Governor Bob Straub said in the introduction to our second annual report in 1978. Energy decisions made in the next months and years will have a lasting impact on Oregon's energy future. So a plan provides you a good, solid foundation. What a plan is it's not a wish list. It reflects today's realities, and it recognizes that times will change. And that was in our second biennial energy plan in 1987. And so finally, in my trip down memory lane and looking at all the historical documents, we live in a world of dwindling energy supplies and rising costs. We are vulnerable, but we are not helpless. And that was a quote from Governor Vic Atiyah in the New Energy Directions for Oregon in 1979. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Madam Chair, let me proceed with questions, I just wanted to kind of put a bow on it or finish this up for you. I'd ask Ms. Enright to go through this, I don't know if you would say painful process, but I think it was a very important process as we were preparing, at least under my agency relationship, to have a kind of sense of where we've been in the history of this state of Oregon as it pertains to energy. Being somebody new to the department, I needed to have a better understanding, a better grasp of what is that history that has preceded me to this point. And so pulling all that information together and reviewing it, I think you can see the report really, well, she's hit it at a high level and there's much more detail in the report, so I encourage you to read that. The reason I chose to use this summary way of defining the planning document that we produced today is to show you that there's a legacy of it. There's a process that has been put out in place. And I wanted to make sure at the end of that we actually talked about that the plan is a plan for what it has been determined for so many years. But that doesn't mean that the plan that we have today can't be something else. And I think Diana's reference to the fact that a plan is a plan, but this is not necessarily a strategy. This plan, if you look at other states who have developed long-term energy strategies, you would find much of the same information embedded in their reports. But they would also have a piece of what is our strategy, where are we going to go, how do we integrate these things in order to accomplish what we want to accomplish. We don't get that far in ours. We look only prospectively a little ways forward, but not 10 years or 5 years or 10 years or further out. That's not to say it can't be accomplished and that we couldn't do that. But it was extremely important, I thought, for the committee to understand the kind of the framework of what the report represents and historically has represented, what it embodies today as we present it to you today, and what it really is, the premise or the strong platform that you can build off of. It's a plan that can be modified, improved, and advanced to really meet levels of expectation by this assembly, this governor, to really meet the futuristic looks of energy roles in Oregon and how it will interface with the citizens of this state.
All right, let me see if there's any questions. I have a couple, but first I'll see if there's any questions from from the dais. Okay, I have a couple of questions, and then I think what I'll do is we'll probably transition after that into the public hearing. But before I introduce my bill, and part of that was this information is very helpful for that, could you talk a little bit about the stakeholder involvement in development of this energy plan and also coordination with the PUC or FSEC in development of this plan, what role they have, and how that fits in with the work that the PUC and FSEC is doing.
Chair Dinkelder, the information I received from the technical experts who provided a lot of the documentation in the energy plan, they work with their peers at the PUC, and they work with their stakeholders. So they provided me, a technology-specific information after they had gone out and talked to folks. And so they gathered that information and provided it to me as the editor of the document. For the FSEC component of it, the information I received was from Tom Stoops, who is the head of the siting division and also the secretary to the Energy Facility Siting Council. So he provided me with the information that he had gathered from attending the council meetings.
Okay. One of the reasons I asked this question, because my observations, at least the 10 years that I've been working directly with the Department of Energy, it's more of an internal planning process versus an external engaging more broad citizen input stakeholders in that process. Am I correct in my assumption there?
Chair Dingfelder, I think that's true. And that's why I focused on where the earlier plan said, you know, utilities and local governments and others to focusing more on a strategy where you involve a greater variety of stakeholders.
Okay. Thank you. Did you want to comment on that at all, Director?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think Diana has portrayed it correctly. The report is an assembly of facts and prior discussions, prior communications with the technical people who work on certain aspects of this program with stakeholders on an ongoing basis. Is there an assembling of those people at the final completion of the document? No, I can tell you that that didn't take place, or it probably historically hasn't taken place. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean, as we've tried to tee up the idea of a strategy, I think an energy plan is a report out of what has been accomplished. An energy strategy is much deeper in discussion with those partners to say, okay, how are we, the collective we, going to get from where we are today to a place that's out further in time? And what are those suggestions and what are those discussions we should have with them? So the strategical thinking of this would be that would be where you bring the larger group of the others together.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions before we open up the public hearing? I want to thank you for being here. I know we have another bill where you're going to testify. I would encourage my colleagues to read this plan. I've every year when they come out, I have read them, and I learn a lot. Certainly it gives an overview perspective for new members who are still learning about all the programs that the Department of Energy implements, and, of course, much of the legislation we've worked on over the years that affect the work that they're doing. So I appreciate it, and it's nice to have this hot off the press. And I'm sure that we'll be hearing more on both these bills. So thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting and open up a public hearing. We're actually going to start with Senate Bill 164. And I will provide a little bit of information after. Beth, you want to provide sort of the overview on Senate Bill 164?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 164 would establish the State Energy Commission consisting of five members appointed by the governor. The bill authorizes the commission to adopt any rules necessary to administer the state energy laws and transfers the rulemaking authority of the director to the commission. It also makes conforming amendments throughout the energy statutes. There's no revenue impact. We have not received a fiscal impact statement, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And since my name is on this bill, I will explain to you a little bit about what the genesis of this bill was. And many of you remember that last session, as we were dealing with issues around some of the programs that the Department of Energy was implementing, the Business Energy Tax Credit, the Residential Energy Tax Credit, one of the things that came to my attention is that we don't have a citizen oversight commission that works with the Department of Energy per se, similar to many of the other agencies that we have, the Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And there was concerns about having more involvement on some of these processes, the rulemaking, development of the energy plan. And so I put out a proposal that you see before you to develop an energy commission, a citizen energy commission. There's been a lot of speculation about what that is, and it's not a new agency. It would be not usurping the PUC or FSEC. That was at least the legislative intent of the person who requested that. It would be part of what you heard today. There isn't really a stakeholder process, a public process for a forward-looking strategy, looking at how we integrate many of our programs across the different agencies that are working on energy. So that was the intent. The bill before you, Senate Bill 164, was drafted to try to capture that. And so there's been a hearing on the other side of the Capitol over in the House on a bill that would restructure Department of Energy. I came up with this proposal. Senator Bailey, or Representative Bailey, I know, put that forward. There was a hearing a couple weeks ago on that. So I think today what we're going to hear is some feedback about this idea. Is a good idea. If not, as you probably heard right now, the director, for instance, an example, adopts the rules. This would, similar to many other agencies, have rulemaking authority transferred to the Citizen Oversight Commission. And then you can obviously read the bill and see what else. But that's sort of the overall intent. So we have probably about 10 people signed up that would like to speak on this and be interested to hear their perspectives. I was going to say, Mr. Repine, did you want to come up and say anything? I didn't see you signed up at all in the bill. Oh, you are. You're in the bottom. So we'll let you come up and say something first, and then we'll pull up the rest of the folks. Sorry, you were hiding down there. I should have just made you stay up there, but it's your exercise for the day.
Yeah, that's what I need. I need more exercise, actually. Chair Dingfeller, committee members, for the record, I am Bob Repine, acting director of the Department of Energy. My comments were going to be really more impromptu comments, not written testimony. Your bill that you've introduced, the bill that the committee has in consideration today, I've not been at the agency long enough to understand necessarily if there's a need for a commission or a council that's prescribed in the bill. But let me step back from that from my now 11 years in state government. I've worked with agencies that, for the most part, at least the two major agencies that I've worked in for over 8 years, have had a council or a commission of some sort. I value that configuration. I think that those citizen individuals who fill that role, taking much of their time away from their normal business, who are willing to commit to the understanding of the details of an agency, play a key role in the ability for an agency to be very successful. So I want to at least go on the record saying that my experience historically has been with that configuration has been a very positive experience. Relative to the piece of legislation you're looking at, as you know, Madam Chair and committee members, there are lots of ways that the committees are constructed, and how they're formulated, where the individuals who represent those seats come from, what's their experience, what's their background. And I think those are some of the more broader discussions that might be held regarding the configuration of a committee like this. But all in all, historically, I think at the end of the day, it enhances the public process and enhances what Oregon stands for. From my past perspective, I have not had any problems with that type of configuration.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions for the director before we call up other witnesses?
Yeah. Just want to say, Bob, glad to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to see that you're kind of at the helm here, and I've always respected the work you've done both as a legislator and in the positions that you've held and making certain we move forward with the best interests of the state and the citizens. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
And for the record, you may want to let folks know what years you served in this body.
Yeah. My time served, you mean?
Your time.
Recovery, yeah. I was a state legislator from 1988 because I was put in during an interim and finished my career in 1997 and then started in state government in 1998 until currently.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. He's recovering.
Yeah.
But he can't get away. 12 steps. You've got about 10 more steps to go, but okay. So we're going to call up Paul Wooden, Ann Hannis, and John Audley, and this does not mean you're necessarily on the same side of the issue, but we've got three seats, so that's how I'm calling you up. Okay. Paul, would you like to start?
Madam Chair, Commissioners, my name is Paul Wooden. I'm the Executive Director for the Community Renewable Energy Association. We are an intergovernmental Chapter 190 agency comprised of local governments and small businesses in support of community renewables. In our role, we work very closely with the Department of Energy and have worked with it through several different administrations over the last several years. First of all, we'd like to thank you, Senator, for introducing this bill. We think it's a bill that will fit in well with what's been happening. We support the concept of an Oregon Energy Commission with some provisions. We believe that an Energy Commission can help provide consistency of policy and guidance that will help shape and implement state energy policy. The Oregon Department of Energy has gone through several years of instability recently, as you're aware. They've seen several director changes, retirements, firings, transferring of key personnel, combined with a number of major changes in policy. We believe it's now time to promote stability in the department. Now is the time for new employees to gain experience and for the agency to better define and implement racially changed policies. We're fortunate to have Director Repine as the current director. He provides a much-needed stability and leadership to a department in need of good management. He's created several advisory panels comprised of stakeholders who have real-world experience in implementing current energy policy. These panels are a much-needed vehicle to fine-tune new policies so they actually work as intended. Our association supports the creation of an energy commission if its goal is to continue and support the kind of work that's been done recently with the department in fine-tuning current policy and recommending refinements as appropriate to the legislature. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of your panel. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Audley. I'm the Deputy Director of the Renewable Northwest Project. For over 17 years, we have been advocating for the responsible siting of renewable energy projects in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. And while I seem to spend more time these days in Helena than Salem, I'm proud to recognize Senator Dingfelder as my representative in Oregon Senate. Well, I recognize the jurisdiction of this committee, and I was fascinated by that history, by the way. I'm a newcomer to the state, and that was a very instructive presentation. My comments today will speak to the other side of renewable energy, namely the role it plays as an important component of Oregon's economy. Nearly $6 billion in renewable energy equipment and companies now create jobs, pay taxes, and sell energy to markets in Oregon and elsewhere around the region. Portland is now home to the largest concentration of renewable energy companies in the nation, due in no small measure to policies set by this body. By our estimates, the roughly $500 million invested by the state through the business energy tax credit incentives was leveraged to bring more than $3.5 billion to Oregon. Page down. We need to be able to work with these businesses as they consider the development and operation of renewable energy projects throughout the state. We need to coordinate the interests of other state agencies whose issues are affected by these projects, from environmental quality to fish and wildlife to human health to transportation to land use management. We need to understand that commitments made by the state to support projects using incentives of one fashion or another must be respected, and we need to help elected officials understand that changing these incentives after they've been promised is bad for the state. I'm here to thank the Senator and the other members of this committee for their support for efforts to make the Department of Energy a more effective representative of the state's interests in renewable energy. I appreciated the directors, as I get it, the difference between a plan and a strategy, and I think that's what I'm trying to speak to. As we pledged Representative Jules Bailey, we commit to work with you to find a way to plan to meet our energy needs in a manner respectful of our environmental goals, build good jobs, and keep Oregon a place where everybody wants to live. Thanks.
Thank you. Ann?
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannis, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Counties have been very interested and have been intensely involved with energy policies and issues for a number of reasons. Rising energy costs, we see with the cost of gasoline rising as fast as it is, has a major impact on county budgets. Counties have been involved with energy siting from a land use standpoint, and energy facilities have generated important revenues and economic development opportunities, including jobs in counties. The Oregon Department of Energy has had a variety of various advisory committees that AOC has been actively involved with, including the recently created Energy Advisory Committee, the Renewable Energy Working Group, or the RUG, the Energy Efficiency Working Group, the OOG, and various other rulemaking committees. I want to thank Senator Dingfelder for introducing this bill because it really highlights the need for developing important policies, rulemakings, and energy strategies and plans in a public forum. We need an energy strategy that provides a pathway to our future that deals with energy development, consumption, and the types of energy generated. We have very much appreciated Director Repine's willingness to include counties on the recently formed Energy Advisory Committee because it has provided stakeholders with the opportunity to discuss issues, propose policies, and rulemaking. We believe that a viable and strong governance structure that provides a public forum for energy issues is important to develop and vet those policy issues, strategic plans and strategies, and rulemaking issues. And we hope that should a commission be established, that one of the members appointed to the commission would be a knowledgeable individual representing local governments. We hope to work with you on this bill and developing any amendments to this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Jeff Bissonette, Steve Schell, and Glenn Montgomery. I'd like to go first. Go ahead, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities working on electricity, natural gas, and telecommunications issues. Like the previous panel, we too have been very involved in a lot of activities focused at the department over the last several years. We sort of view this particular issue of kind of the future of ODO, broadly stated, of somewhere between doing nothing and, you know, blowing up the department as another piece of legislation proposes. And frankly, we're at neither of those extremes. We would like to see something done. We're not to the point where we think that the plug needs to be pulled on the agency, but you know, we do need, in our view, additional policy direction in terms of development of energy policy in the state, as well as a clear rulemaking process. I will add my voice to the current acting director for his efforts to create the advisory committees, but I don't think that you know, clear and transparent rulemaking process can depend on whoever happens to hold the director's chair. And so we support this bill in the sense that we think it's a good place to start the conversation about what we really need in terms of energy policy and energy administration. And like others, we look forward to being a part of the continuing conversation. I would be happy to answer questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Schell. I've been involved in several aspects of public service over my 40-year career as a lawyer, including service on the Land Conservation Development Commission, the Energy Facility Siting Council, the Energy Trust of Oregon, and I've been involved with the governor's advisory group on climate change in 2004. So I've rolled through this issue of creating new agencies and new entities and tried to figure out how to do that if that's really the intent. I agree with Senator Dingfelder that this is a problem that needs to be solved for Oregon. And the way to approach it, it seems to me, is to start with a commission. But I'd really disagree with the bill in some respects in that I think it needs to be a tougher commission than is outlined in the bill. So I tried to put together my thoughts for you based on a long time of public service and participation in energy-related activities. And I came up with a sort of cutesy
6C process, and I'd offer that for you as a means of trying to get hold of what I'm suggesting. The first thing I think you need to think about is consolidation. How do we put all of these facets of energy together in one place? And I suggest that you consider combining not just energy, but energy, sustainability, adaptation, and global climate change issues all in one place. Put that together. If you go with what Senator Kitzhaber or Governor Kitzhaber, I've got to get this right.
Hopefully he's not listening to
you. Yeah, right. said in City Club, I think last Friday, he talked about the need to recognize that we need some changes in the assumptions that we're making. We need to figure out how to proceed in a different manner at this time. He used this age of paradox as a kind of a mechanism for getting at this. But that's the message. We're in a tough place right now economically. I had a chance to look fairly closely at the reset, and I understand the $3.5 billion or whatever it is deficit that the general fund has now. If you consolidate, you get a chance to put things together in a more effective way. And that means, I think, taking not just the Department of Energy and creating a commission for it, not just coordinating, but providing some real teeth for the organization. The second thing that I'd submit to you, and again, I have an outline of ideas here that I'm not going to try to articulate in a hearing, but we need to take the carbon reduction standards, we need to take the renewable portfolio standards, we need to take the integrated resource plans and put those kinds of things together in a workable model so one can see the whole package rather than just taking a piecemeal approach to the situation. LCDC needs to be brought in this. I had a hand in writing Goal 13. I think Goal 13 should go. I don't think it does the job. But as Diana Enright said, it's a reflection of the times. That was the issue in 1975 when Goal 13 was put together. It emphasized energy conservation. And that still should be the emphasis. That's clearly the message that comes out of the Northwest, whatever we're calling it these days, Power Planning Council is what I keep calling it. But whatever, that's the message that comes out, and it should be followed. The next thing I want to talk about a little bit is how to get clarity. I don't think we can come together if we don't have clear understandings of what our objectives are. I had a hand in writing the first 15 goals for LCDC, and I think we were fuzzy in how we approach things. We need to be very clear, and I like standards that say, you know, we're going to get 25% by 2025. We're going to get 10% of 1990 standards by 2020. Those are clear strategies that people can take and implement in various ways. So clarity is very, very important in this situation. The next thing is consensus. We've got to figure out how to bring consensus around these ideas. The governor can say what he wants. The legislature can pass bills. We can have committees and agencies all over. But until we get consensus from the public, we're not going to get the kind of momentum we had. In the LCDC process, there was a requirement for 10 hearings around the state before a plan was adopted. I suggest you think about that for a new plan and strategy if that's the direction that you take. I think it worked reasonably well. I think there was a lot of activity on that. There were some 200 meetings and probably 10,000 people showed up at hearings. We now have Twitter and we have other kinds of things that allow people to participate abroad, but we need to bring those together in order to develop the necessary consensus. Then I urge you to think about giving this agency clout and giving it the ability to work, including, I suggest, appointment of the director by the commission. And the reason for that is if you look at what happened over the last two or three years, one of the reasons for the department's difficulty, I think, is we got a little confused about who had authority and who didn't have authority. If the governor wants to deal with the commission, that's great. The commission should appoint the director. And I really urge you to think through that kind of activity. The other thing that you have to think about is how to get these agencies to work together. One of our big problems is the siloing. We set aside all of these, we set these agencies in place, and then we never develop mechanisms for getting them to come together effectively. Coordination and stakeholders are not sufficient terms in this. We have to move beyond coordination and stakeholders in order to work at this. We need to have particularly these commissioners focus on the public interest. So I would disagree with Ann Hannis in the sense of having one seat for the county or one seat for this or one seat for that. That's not a good solution. The public interest has to be, I suggest, the basis for decision making. Next, I want to talk a little bit about compliance. How do you get performance? Well, you have to have a way to resolve the agency tensions because there's overlap and there is siloing. You have to, and that's one of the first things you need to focus on. I've got an idea. I'm not sure that's the best idea, but I put it out here for you to think about. You know, give it to the governor. If the governor doesn't respond, send it to the agency when there's overlap and lack of coordination. There are also some standard administrative tools available for compliance. One of the things that I might mention, and just to make perfectly clear, I think you can merge the Energy Facility Siting Council into the Energy Commission. The way it works is there's usually a hearings officer appointed, and that hearings officer winnows down the case. It's a very complicated process, but the hearings officer winnows down the facts, and the issues are presented to the Energy Facility Siting Council. At least that's how it was when I served. That can be done by the Energy Commission serving as the Energy Facility Siting Council in order to preserve the rules that the FSEC has. It has special appeal processes and other activities. Finally, if you don't fund this, don't do it. You've got to find a way to fund it. And you can't use the general fund. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that that's not going to be available. Now, most of the Energy Department's activity is funded by non-general fund money. And so you keep that in mind. But I think it has to be a combination of fees and grants and maybe a small tax, maybe on construction. You obviously can't do it on gasoline because of the constitutional provision. But you've got to think through how to fund it adequately in order to make it happen. And if you're not going to do that, don't bother, really. It'll just make a mess or a further mess. So, in a nutshell, that's kind of my heavy take on this. If I can be of help and you want to put together some kind of a work group, I'd be glad to participate.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your thoughtful input on this and your many years of service.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. OSEIA is a trade group that's exclusively focused on the solar industry in Oregon, and we've been around since 1981. I'm going to keep my comments brief. I suggested on the sign-up sheet that I'm neutral to this bill only because I think there's some good things in this bill, and I'm supportive of the spirit behind the bill. I think I have an alternative vision for what this commission might be responsible for. In my opinion, if we are going to establish an energy commission, I'd like to avoid creating what might become a bureaucratic organization and something akin to what we have seen happen in some of our other boards that agencies are reporting to. So that would be one goal, regardless of what the charter of this commission is that if we can avoid adding another layer of bureaucracy, that's a good thing, and also avoiding politicization. I think this commission needs to have a more visionary mission and a specific charter. I would agree with Steve in terms of giving it clout, allowing it a budget to operate. And when I think about a model of success that we've had in Oregon in the last few years that comes to mind, it would be the Oregon Innovation Council. If we had a commission that was designed more around that type of a model and less so around the Oregon Sustainability Board model, I think we're heading in the right direction. Oregon Innovation Council has a group of experts, and I would suggest that we need more than five on this commission, but it has a group of experts that's backed by technical expertise. They invite the participation of industry and the public to come up with the best proposals for moving Oregon forward. And in this case, it would be with regard to an energy plan. They take those proposals, they vet them, they come up with specific recommendations that they put forth to the governor, and the governor determines whether or not to incorporate that into the budget and into the plan. I would suggest that that might be a model that we consider as we think about an energy commission. And give that energy commission a charter that says you have to have actionable recommendations. I would spend less time on administrative rulemaking. I think there's other ways that we can be more effective in the outreach and the administration of rules, and give them more of a strategic charter that helps us to get Oregon on the right track, pointing the needle towards a carbon-free economy, and avoiding getting into the weeds of the administration of the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'm going to leave my comments at that, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Are there any questions? Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Mr. Schell.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
I'm a general contractor, and when you put a levy on state fee on all building, construction, and development permits, that weighs heavily on my industry. And do you think it's fair that just one sector pays for the entire process?
No, I don't think it's fair that just one sector pays for the entire process. On the other hand, if you think about the way development works, development requires the additional people and a combination of additional people, and construction is one of those means. I represent construction contractors, and I have folks involved in that issue. But thinking through how the overall process works as a public interest standpoint, I think a very small tax can work effectively. Real estate is used as a basis in Washington County, and people may not like that basis, but that is another possible basis for some kind of a small increment that would be directly funded and earmarked for this agency. So I don't say absolutely that construction is where it ought to be, but there needs to be something.
Follow-up comment. One thing about the state of Oregon is nothing ever remains small.
That's true.
Thank you. Other questions for the panelists? Witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. And we have Angus Duncan, who has signed up. Would anybody else like to come up and testify on Senate Bill 164? Come on up. Welcome, gentlemen.
Madam Chair.
Get going.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. I chair the state's Global Warming Commission. I am a former member and chair of the Northwest Power Planning Council, so I've had some upfront and personal exposure to energy policy making and strategy making. And so I want to try to offer some comments at 15 or 20,000 feet. I've provided a somewhat more detailed memorandum there on the subject. But I want to testify to the importance of planning deliberately and systematically for Oregon's energy future and having the right institutional tools to do it. Energy is like land, like air, like water. It is a necessary, enabling, and ultimately limiting factor in most human activities. If we manage it well and efficiently, it will support a great many and diversity of those activities. If we're sloppy or casual with it, or if we assume it is inexhaustible and treat it that way, it will become more a limiting than an enabling factor. We manage our supplies of air, land, and water directly with state policies and planning, and we charge citizen commissions to develop policy directions and benchmarks for success in doing so. We charge them with overseeing department implementing functions, and we ask them to engage the public in shaping policies that the public then, has skin in and will support. When we organize the Department of Energy as a home for the necessary regulatory and programmatic energy functions, we short-sheeted it. We did not give it the kind of comparable commission to carry out the policy, the oversight, and the public engagement functions, and we should have done so. Doesn't mean we don't have energy policies. Does mean that we tend to create them more piecemeal than systematically. Sometimes we create them by more by looking, you know, in the rearview mirror than out the front windshield. And that's why governors have felt compelled to set up ad hoc groups to try to take on one piece or another of our energy policy needs. So there's the RUG and the UG, and there was an energy policy council that Governor Kulongowski set up. There are a number of other task forces. And task forces frequently can do good work, but they frequently end up doing it out of context. And I've served on many of them, and I have the sense, as I think many folks have had, of being told to come up with a renewable energy policy, but not really understanding how that's going to interconnect, for example, with a transmission policy or an energy efficiency policy. You know, we make them do this out of context. We end up with equally ad hoc public commentary. And having an energy strategy is one thing. Having a legitimized energy strategy, one that has been vetted with the public, is something quite different. The Governor's Energy Policy Council, on which I spent the better part of 2 years trying to get their hands around one very small piece of, not small, but one piece of the puzzle, which was electric transmission policy. And the comment I heard most often in that process, and this was from particularly but not exclusively utilities, was the difficulty of contemplating the kind of transmission, the growth and development of the transmission system that we really need to have if we're going to integrate the kind of new technologies that are coming down the pipeline, to try to do that without public buy-in for the kinds of investments we have to make, the kinds of impositions that we have to make on public and private lands. You know, there was not the legitimacy to that public policy, and believe me, the Energy Policy Council did not provide it. I would equally argue that this kind of a commission, you know, exercising oversight over how the BETCY program was deployed and administered, might better have aligned that program with any number of broader state outcomes, you know, including but not limited to fiscal responsibility. There has occasionally been discussion. I know that we have a Public Utility Commission. Maybe that's the place where these responsibilities are already being carried out or where they should be lodged. And I take second place to none in my admiration for what an exceptional job I think our Public Utility Commission has done over the last 20 or 30 years. But planning and policymaking are not an easy fit with the kind of economic rate regulation that is the core mission of the Public Utility Commission. Equally, it's hard for that commission to figure out how to integrate investor-owned utility and consumer-owned utility participation and contributions to achieving overall state energy policy. It doesn't look at transportation energy consumption, which is about 40% of our energy consumption in the state, nor does it look at industrial direct market energy purchases. So there are some big gaps there, but generally, I think even more broadly, it's just not a comfortable fit. Does this kind of a proposition add value to the state, and is it added value that is sufficient for the legislature to move this piece of legislation through? We asked ourselves that question when we were working on the Northwest Power Act back in the mid-late 1970s, and we were contemplating the kind of planning and policymaking and analytic functions and giving them an institutional home. And ultimately, you know, we collectively, the four states, decided that was an important part of the Northwest Power Act, and I won't go through all of the twists and turns. Suffice it to say that one of the consequences of that decision is that this region has developed roughly the equivalent of two Grand Coulee dams worth of energy efficiency in the last 20 years and proposes to acquire another three Grand Coulees worth of energy efficiency in the next 20 years. And that's made possible by the kind of policies and the kind of planning and analysis that underlie regional energy policy. We've got a lot of challenges that we are facing in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Many of these, by the way, we try to identify in my commission's roadmap to 2020, which we hope to deliver to the legislature next week as a part of our reporting obligation. But integrating new variable renewable generation technologies, you know, adding the kind of sophisticated information and control, you know, technologies, you know, superimposing them onto the top of the generation and the consumption, you know, energy system, so that we squeeze the kind of efficiencies out of that system that we need to, because we can't build our way out of load growth. Linking utilities in electric vehicle transportation strategies, and obviously and ultimately meeting our carbon goals. All of those things are challenges that I don't think we are institutionally equipped at this point to rise up to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Angus.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fred Hewitt. I live in Portland, Oregon. And today, speaking on my own behalf, not on behalf of any organization I'm currently or have ever been associated with, I want to bring a little bit more historical background to this discussion and then talk about the process going forward. First, I want to thank Senator Dingfelder and also Representative Bailey for bringing new perspectives or refreshed perspective on the role of the Department of Energy to the legislature. This is very important to do. My overview of this would be, in 1973, the legislature set out a very broad and, I think, had, in retrospect, very effective framing for the issue of energy and what role it plays in our society, in our economy, in our environment. And the basic framework in ORS 469.010, which is well worth reading, it's very short, is something that I really hope that we maintain as our perspective going forward. The planning processes that were put in place in the following decade, including the state energy plan, were addressing the kinds of issues and constraints and challenges of that time, and I think have served us well for the last now almost 40 years. Now it's time to think about what kind of planning process and oversight process we need, guidance, strategy that we need in the state for the next 40 years. The challenges are old, but the challenges are definitely new. Climate was not on our agenda back then. It certainly is now. The constraints of oil and the challenges of very rapidly rising oil prices have now been joined by a sense that oil really is, I don't know if I would say peak, but certainly we're seeing global supply-demand constraints, which are probably permanently raising the price, and you get a reminder of that every time you go by a gas station or fill up your car, and that we're not going back to $2 a gallon gas. Among other things, this means that there will be a major shift toward transportation being electrified, which raises a lot of issues that lay on top of issues that we've been wrestling with for the last 40 years. In 1983, I had a helping hand in helping to pass Senate Bill 212, which formulated the state energy plan. At the time, I had just laid myself off as the second executive director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. During a very severe recession, we couldn't even pay my then meager salary. So I spent my time during unemployment looking for work and down here trying to help address the issue of trying to get a permanent legislation for the state energy plan. Once that was done, with the bipartisan assistance of the predecessor of this committee, including, as I recall then, Senator Ted Halleck as chair, Senator Kulongoski, Senator Wires, Jan Wires, Senator George Wingard, Senator Tom Hartung, and I believe Senator Kitzhaber was involved in there too, as well as others, I floated the idea of doing an energy commission, but it really didn't seem possible to pull off at that point. There was too much else on the agenda. The state was in very difficult financial circumstances, and it just didn't seem like it was the time to move forward. So I'm very pleased to see that the idea has come back in a much more robust form. I want to address a couple of issues going forward. One is, as previous speakers have indicated, and I think we've already seen a very interesting variety of opinions and views on how to move forward. One of the key aspects of this is coordination. We have a number of state agencies. There are gaps and overlaps between them. It's time to step back and think about how all those things will be coordinated. There's been a lot of really good thought put into this, and now is the time to start really putting it in place so that we have something that will stand the test of time over the next four decades. I really appreciate Representative Bailey's putting out his bill. I think we all have questions about the approach he's proposing. But one of the points he made was that the energy and climate, I presume he would say also climate planning process, has to really truly be coordinating. It cannot be just, as Steve Schell said, a number of silos that are poorly coordinated with each other. Representative Bailey's floated the idea of pushing this closer to the governor's office. I think we will have that discussion going forward. But coordination is crucially important in order to accommodate all of the issues that are under this tent. The second question is scope. And here I will refer to climate. I'm very pleased that Angus and others have brought this to the table. I think those of us who've been thinking about this approach for an energy commission have been wrestling with whether it's time to incorporate climate into the scope directly from the front end. And I have to say at this point, regardless of what you may think on the climate issue and various aspects of it, it really should be. How to do that and what, how to phase it in and how to deal with the existing commission and the other efforts of the state, those are things we can work on. But it really should be directly integrated into this from the very start. And the last thing I'll talk about is something I would call, I'm not exactly sure how to describe this, the Oregon way of doing things. The Energy Commission would join, as Senator Dingfelder laid out, the other commissions we have in our state that have functioned. Some of them have had better results than others, but it provides public transparency, it provides accountability, it provides for voice, it provides for balance, and it is the Oregon way of doing things, and I think we're, in effect, really long overdue to put an energy commission in place and deal with the different pieces that are on the table. So with that, I thank you very much and hope to participate in this going forward.
Thank you. Questions? Questions? Okay. I actually have one.
Yes, ma'am.
And it relates to a question that Senator Olson asked, and I'll be putting you guys a little bit on the spot, but there was a comment made about if we're going to move forward with this, it's got to be well-funded and staffed. Do you have any thoughts about funding?
I have some very mature thoughts about funding and then the constraints that its absence imposes on a state commission that is endeavoring to meet its legislatively directed responsibilities.
And I knew you would because you've been dealing with that directly.
Basically, to the extent that we have, my commission has had to come up with ready cash to put to have a website so that we could perform our public engagement function, to undertake the development of the roadmap to 2020. Also one of our responsibilities, and now to take it out as we plan to do this spring on the road to Eugene, to Bend, to Medford, probably two or three sessions in the Portland area over to Newport. All of that is basically funded by my going to commissions or to foundations and sometimes to corporations to see if I can get them to put up some cash. I have been fortunate, our commission has been fortunate to have staff support from the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, DLCD, and other departments, and certainly without that kind of expert technical help, you know, we would have been even more hamstrung. But yes, it is important to have at least some minimal logistical and administrative support so that the legislature does not impose a large dose of responsibility with limited authority and no resources.
Greg, do you have some ideas?
Chair Dingfelder, yes. I think the first part is if we really think this is this serious, and it is, we shouldn't be relying merely on Angus's well-known ability to his great powers of persuasion when he has the begging bowl out. And really, if we're going to take this seriously, we have to find a way to fund it. But I also want to refer, if I may, to Senator Olson's question. If we're going to do that, it has to be done fairly, and the people who are providing the money, whether it's taxpayers or through some other method, have to be assured that the results are worth it and have to know that they have a full stake and full direct involvement if they wish.
And, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, one more comment. Sort of true to my heritage, I think that this kind of activity can be undertaken for a pretty minimal commitment of state resources. And if you look, in effect, at the budget that we have operated on as a commission over the last 36 months, I think that's probably a fair level of support given the fiscal constraints that the state finds itself in today.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Your input. Okay. I don't have anybody else signed up. Going once, going twice. Anybody on Senate Bill 164? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 164. We will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 167. And Beth, can you provide an overview? Is there last bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 167 requires the Director of the Department of Energy to make the record of the State Department of Energy account available to all interested parties prior to entering an order establishing the amount of revenue required to be derived from the energy resource supplier assessment. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. We haven't received one, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Can I ask Bob Repine if he can come up, provide an overview, because I have a feeling some people don't know what the energy supplier assessment is or does, and then we have a couple of people signed up to testify. And this is your bill, so we'll defer.
My bill. Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I am Acting Director Bob Repine for the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy brings to you Senate Bill 167. I might go on the record and let you know it's our only bill we introduced in this legislative session to help lighten the load. So in front of you, pardon me?
We appreciate that.
So Senate Bill 167 was a bill that deals with the Energy Supplier Assessment, better known as ESA. And for those who were not in the Ways and Means panel, I'll probably briefly go through this for you. The Energy Supplier Assessment was found in Oregon Revised Statutes 469.421, if you want some reading later. And it really is a fee that's assessed on the utilities, the independent power producers, and fuel suppliers to fund the activities of the department as required by law, which do not have an alternative source of funding. Generally, today, the ESA funds most of the activities around staffing, including technical, management, and administrative staff for the department. Better way to give you a reference point, the agency, through many of its programs, have other funds that come in to support those services. So, as an example, the Energy Siting Council covers its costs, most of their costs, from charging the applicant for those costs associated with the research and the report and the final certification. The BETSI, the Business Energy Tax Credit Program, is a application-based funding source for that program. So the agency has a variety of funding sources that we derive through fees or associated costs that are recovered to the department. We use we figure out the budget of the agency and then determine what is the budget need versus how much money is coming in from those other sources, subtract the two, and get to a number that would be the amount of money that would be determined to be the funds necessary from this assessment that we charge annually. So that's how we derive the fund. So it fills the gap is a better way of describing it. Generally speaking, as I mentioned, most of it is for staffing, for central operation costs associated with those things. We do use it as a funding source for the siting process. We, even though we have the ability to recover those costs, we have to pay additional costs over time, and we recover those costs on not a 30-day basis, but a little extended basis. And so we have to have some cash float, and so the ESA fund works as the cash float for us, of which then we replenish it when those fees come in from the applicants for the siting council work. We also have used this fund in the past for special projects or transfers, research program sponsorships, governor and legislative directed expenditures, and so it has been tapped in a variety of areas over the time of the history of this program. So again, the bill that is in front of you today basically deals with two issues that were brought up in the 75th Oregon Legislative Assembly, where through discussions with the payers of this fee, were concerned that there was a lack of transparency of how these funds were being spent by the department. So with the stakeholders' feedback, we keyed up on two issues. One was that we needed to find the way to determine the ESA expenditures and associated rates had historically not been transparent, and so we had to address that. And we also wanted to be able to work in the vein of the governor's office and the legislature, that they directed us to spend ESA funds on activities and staffing in other agencies that may not be a clear link to the priorities of the department. So there were some expenditures in the past that the ESA partners were having a hard time making that determination. And so with that, you have House Senate Bill 167 in front of you. This bill was a bill that was cooperatively formed and formatted with the partners of the ESA partners, those people who pay those fees. We sat down and made the determination of what they were trying to accomplish with the bill. And so, quite frankly, the bill is relatively short, and it deals with two areas that we support and introduce the legislation that defines the activities and where the funds are spent in the department primarily, and that we keep that transparency and communication going with the ESA partners through the term of that relationship. And so effectively that's what the bill does. We understand that there was another bill introduced in the House Bill 2735, which is a similar bill to this. It was actually introduced by the assessment suppliers group. And we understand that that bill might be possibly going to be some amendments be folded into this bill for consideration, that we would just have one vehicle that would accomplish it. We worked with the group on their amendments this week. We're in support of those amendments, and I think they will be bringing those forward to you today.
Okay, thank you, Director. I do have a question. So the bill is, I just want to clarify, consensus bill from the work group?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Questions? Okay.
In particular with the amendments, I think you'll find it's a consensus bill.
Okay, yes. I think we'll hear a little bit more. And Senator Thompson and I heard extensive information about this in the Ways and Means Subcommittee and part of your budget, and that's available publicly on the intranet. Well, it's intranet, and I'm assuming on your website.
Website,
as well.
Information that we submitted to you as well. Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Kevin Owens. Like to come up, and Ted Case, and then anybody else that would like to come up and testify on 167. Okay. Noah? Why don't you sit on deck? I don't know if we can get all four, so Marion, that'd be great. Okay. Whoever would like to go first?
I'll defer to Ms. Romaine here.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Janelle Romaine for the record, representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association. Kevin will deliver our substantive testimony. Because Director Repine mentioned the amendments to the bill, which aren't ready today, I thought I would talk about what's in them. The first amendment basically adds the advisory committee on the energy supplier assessment. The department has proactively formed this advisory committee with ESA payers already, so the advisory committee would be put into statute in the amendment and would start in January 2012. And the second part of the amendment would give the department the option of billing ESA payers electronically or with regular mail instead of using certified mail or registered mail. So it's just to clean up that the mailing options. And with that, I'll give it to Kevin.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Owens. I'm general manager of Columbia River PUD in St. Helens. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Oregon PUD Association, which has five Oregon PUDs that provide electric service in the state of Oregon. Oregon PUDs collectively serve about 175,000 Oregonians, and we deliver over 4 million megawatt hours of energy. Each of our PUDs is governed by five locally elected board members. The ESA was created by statute to provide supplemental funding for the activities of the Energy Facility Siting Council, the Department of Administrative Services, as well as the Department of Energy for services related to the regulation of energy facilities and facility siting as determined by the Oregon Department of Energy. The purpose of this legislation, SB 167, is to keep the money generated from the ESA within the Department of Energy for their exclusive use. The genesis of this was the 2009 session when we saw ESA funds starting to get diverted to activities and staffing in other agencies with no direct linkage to Oregon Department of Energy programs or activities that served absolutely no benefit to the ESA payers. This bill seeks to keep those funds within the Department of Energy for use on programs that benefit just those ESA payers. It is also our intent that through this legislation, or an amendment if necessary, to make permanent the current ESA Advisory Committee that Mr. Repine mentioned earlier at the Department of Energy to weigh in and comment on ESA expenditures and how those funds are being utilized. The Department of Energy's reliance on ESA funding has grown from 26% to 37% of their operating budget over the last 6 years, as represented in their 2011-2013 biennium budget. Our primary concern with this is that as their reliance on the ESA grows, so will its need to increase the assessment to maintain service levels. These assessments are passed on to utilities as an increased operating cost that will be borne by our customers, the ones that can least afford it in these challenging times. This bill is a good start at limiting the use of these ESA funds and controlling the cost for our customers. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. And could you just, since we did discuss this in the Ways and Means Committee, but clarify for my committee members who exactly, when you say the payers are, and I know that some of the stakeholders are, but it's not an inclusive list. So just give examples, because it's not just utilities.
Generating, delivering energy within the state of Oregon. That is gasoline supplier, fuel suppliers. It's all the renewables folks, as well as Portland General Electric, Pacific, investor-owned utilities, as well as all the consumer-owned utilities.
Okay. And I'm going to ask the department to follow up with a list. I know that you have it because I've seen it, and I think it would be helpful information for this committee to have as well. Okay. Thank you. Ted?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. OREC represents 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon, 200,000 consumers served by 30,000 miles of line. I'll be exceedingly brief. I think that the previous speakers have talked about this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and support SB 167. Electric cooperatives pay about $218,000 into the energy supplier assessment. Whether it's Lane Electric or Douglas Electric or Hood River Electric, no problem paying that fund, but the expectation is that the funds would go to the priorities and programs of the Oregon Department of Energy. And what we have found is that the fund has become somewhat of an inviting target for others that want to fund other programs that are somewhat extraneous to the department. So we think this legislation will go a long way towards addressing that situation, and certainly want to commend the Department of Energy for their accommodation and working with the stakeholders, and certainly appreciate the chair holding this hearing today. So thank you for the opportunity.
And I heard you say $218,000. Is that per year or per biennium?
That's per year for the 18. That's collectively of the 18 electric co-ops.
Okay. We do have a list here, and we'll make sure and get that out to the committee members. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Senator Olson.
What is the total overall budget of the ESA? How much money goes into it?
It's about 2010, it was $4.7 million.
I saw five in the visit. 4.75.
Well, yeah.
And we can have the department come up and answer those questions.
More precise, yeah.
And I told you I was going to make it hard on you. If we...
Is he pointing to you guys? I didn't know which...
Yeah. If we open this door and put a lock on these funds, every other agency in town is going to come in for the same thing. To lock their funds, to make sure that their funds are not touched by anybody else. Are these the state's funds, the people's funds, or are these yours funds?
Well, they're funds that are coming from the utilities and energy suppliers in the state to the Department of Energy. I'm not seeing a problem with the question you're asking or whatever. If they're collected for a purpose, they should stay with that purpose.
My only problem is, and this is just very minor, is that I don't want every other agency coming in with this lockbox mentality saying that We put our funds in here, and this is for this reason. And it's a good reason to put it in there. But then everybody else is going to come in and want that same lockbox mentality, which really hinders the ability to budget money across the realm of our fiscal problems.
So I think you might need to clarify that this is not going directly into the general fund, but it's set aside for specific purposes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, the difference between this fund is that the actual assessment is set after the legislature adjourns by the department. So it's not something that that you work on during the in the Ways and Means Committee. It's
and why don't we have the department come up, and if unless there's other questions specifically for them,
fine.
Why don't I have the department come back up and can explain a little bit more about how this is set, because it's not very intuitive for folks who haven't worked on this for a long time. It took me a while to get my arms around it.
Thank you.
Did you have any questions for these panels? Okay. And we can also maybe have you follow up with that ESA 101 if we need to.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, it's not part of the typical budgeting process, so I might want to explain that a little bit more.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Bob Repine, Acting Director of the Department of Energy. If you would restate the question so I make sure you answer correctly.
I think Senator Olson just asked, if you can explain how the ESA funds are set and how they're different from, you know, they're not going into the general fund and how you come up with that assessment.
Okay, sure. The best way to describe it is the agency has a series of other funding sources that we have through the Betsy program, through the Siting Council, through a variety of other funds that come into the agency. When we build our budget, the use of the ESA funds is designed to be, when we determine the budget operational costs of those things in total, taking out those things that are covered through those other fees that come into the department, which include federal funds that we receive as well, the difference, when you subtract the two, becomes the amount of money that we calculate to divide amongst the 63 partners that are associated with the ESA funds. And so I shared with the chair through staff a list of those. And so they're everything from $1 million a year from Portland General Electric to $251 to a small rural electricity company. The way we calculate this is based on their sales of power, how much the power that they sell in the state of Oregon, both power and petroleum. We have, by statute, a 0.5% cap on that amount. Currently, to support the fees that are being collected today, that is a 0.069%. So we currently are using a 0.069% factor against their bills to come up with that value, to get to that determination, while in fact the cap is a 0.5, so it's, you know, a larger number, as you can see. So again, it's calculated, and then that determination is divided to come up with that multiplying effect, and that's how the fee is. So we go through that same process on the next year, determine what our costs are against our budgeting, and take all things in consideration and determine whether or not we move from that 0.06 that is there today. Does it go up? Does it go down? And historically, it has been the same. Excuse me, the 0.069. It's been consistent for, I think, for the last 3 or 4 years.
And just to clarify, my understanding about why this bill is before you, and I realize we still have Marion who wants to come and testify, is because even though it says in the statute, and I'm looking on page 3, subsection 8, or starting on lines 11, where it says what the intent of the ESA is, and I'm reading this, part of it's to clarify that it is not just for, well, it's for FSEC and the Oregon Department of Administrative Services as related to the Oregon Facility Siting Council. My understanding is the reason this is before us because the people who pay the bill were concerned about how those funds were being used, that they were being used too broadly. Is that a good assessment?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think what they have seen is in the more recent history, there some of these funds have been used for a variety of other activities. To name a few, I think last session the legislature approved the use of a position using ESA funds for the Department of Agriculture in energy-related activities. Two positions that were made available through the Business and Consumers Office for energy-related activities. The funds that were used to one-time funds to pay for the staffing for the East programs, House Bill 2626, came from the ESA funds as well. So I think what the providers are saying, we're seeing that starting to become more prevalent, and so because of that, we want to try to put some sideboards on it.
So the way I read this, there already are some sideboards in existing statute, but mm-hmm. it's, if anything, to sort of strengthen those sideboards. So that was my understanding from the discussions of last session.
Correct.
I'm seeing nodding from the folks behind us. Okay. Okay. Any other questions?
I do have one question.
Yes.
And this is my newness, if you will, and I apologize for this. What exactly do you spend this money on?
Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Olson, currently the department uses most of the ESA funds today to pay for the central operations. Those items that we cannot directly correspond or correlate to a expense center or income center that is derived through some other process. And so there are always the director's office, as it would be an example. My Department of Human Services is under this as well. Those are costs that are more indirect relations, so you can't really get an assignment from some of the other cost centers. And so that's where these funds have historically been used.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to hear from Marion, which is the last one up.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'll be exceedingly brief. You had asked in the beginning whether...
Can you just state your name, please?
Oh, Marion Haynes with Portland General Electric, Portland General Electric was a part of the stakeholder process. You had asked if this was a consensus bill that's before you, and we were part of the process and do support the bill, particularly with the addition of the amendment that Danelle Romaine spoke to about the advisory committee. We appreciate that the department has taken it on its own to create that advisory committee, but believe that having that in statute would be a good thing to assure that interaction going forward. I just wanted to add our voice of support to that, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167. Colleagues, I do encourage, I am going to sort of suggest as homework reading this plan, because as we have other energy bills that come forward, it's very helpful on background. That is it for this week. Next week, we will have... Beth will be here next week, right? We're going to have a guest. Yeah, we're going to have a guest committee staff the following part of the week.
No way.
And with that, we will adjourn.